The Tom Woods Show, episode 1281.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, you'll never guess, I have yet another free ebook out. If you're like me, you stand up and cheer when professors resist the PC culture in universities. Well, I got a bunch of great stories for you in my new book, Think for Yourself, Professors Who Resisted the Mob Tell Their Stories. Grab your copy at againstthemob.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. We are approaching the 100th anniversary of the armistice that ended World War I. That happened on November 11th, 1918. So I thought this was an opportune time to revisit this particular moment in history. And who better to do that with us than the author of the book I think is the indispensable volume for you to read on this subject, namely The Great War, Western Front and Home Front, by our guest Hunt Tooley. Hunt is professor of history and chairman of the history department at Austin College in Sherman, Texas, and he is an associate editor of The Independent Review, which is the academic journal of the Independent Institute. Hunt, welcome back.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be here.
You know, what's interesting is 4 years ago, I had what I called World War I week on my podcast, where I did 5 episodes all about World War I in 1 week because, of course, it was 100 years since the beginning of the war. Yes. And here we are because I'm a persistent guy. I'm still podcasting. And now we've reached 100 years since the ending of the war. And this month, 100 years ago. So I thought that's also important to talk about. We talked a bit about the origins of the war and the who was who and what led up to it and some of that. Here, I'd like to talk more about the ending of the war, the year 1918, the long-term consequences, things like that. But can you just start by painting a picture for us of what does World War I look like at the beginning of 1918? Who are the contending parties? And what would you say are their relative strengths at this point?
Well, by 1918, of course, the Americans had been in the war for months since April 1917. And the American First Army was building in Europe. So the Americans were about to be a part of it. A few Americans saw combat in the beginning of 1918, but it wasn't really until the spring and early summer that American units came online. And I say that because in this vast contest between the British and the French and the Russians on one side and on the other side, the Germans and Austro-Hungarians, and of course the Ottoman Turks with others on both sides, that this thing had become a kind of stalemate, and not just on the war fronts, but a kind of strategic stalemate across the board, even by 1917. And that this is why it's so important to count in the, first of all, the two revolutions in Russia, one, a kind of moderate revolution in early 1917, then, of course, the Bolshevik Revolution in October. But in between those, of course, the United States comes into the fray. So we take one away from the Allied or Entente powers, and then we add one to those powers. And, of course, Italy is fighting, I should mention, Italy is fighting in the is a major power on the side of the Entente as well. But we're looking at stalemate, Tom. I mean, it's basically by the time you get to 1917 stalemate, and then the Americans come in, it's the strongest country economically on the face of the earth, has tremendous sort of undeveloped military potential. And in a situation of stalemate, when you add, you know, a 1,000-pound gorilla to one side of the equation, then things are going to change. So what happens in early 1918 is that the Germans plan one big roll of the dice, take all those troops freed up by the Russian collapse and the Bolshevik withdrawal from the war, and they put all those troops on the Western Front in what was called the Kaiser's Battle, and it was a last-ditch effort to break that stalemate. They almost did it, and it launched off in March. And then a series of huge attacks in April and May, led by this sort of evil genius of the 20th century's worst ideas, Ludendorff, who was the managing general of the German armies. This thing nearly broke through to Paris. It had the British field commander issuing a note that said, well, with our backs to the wall, we have to fight to the death. I mean, it sounded like a note from a general who knew he was about to lose. But at this moment, then, the American units and many other units from around the world, the French drew in every sort of colonial troop, the British the same, and the Americans then formed a kind of bulwark to help out in all this. And the tide turned over the month of June. And by the time we get to the beginning of August, Ludendorff is talking about how they've just had the black day of the German army. And so the German army begins to retreat, not collapse at all, the way the Russian armies had, but just to retreat back from the front lines. So there's a continuous battle until November 11th, when the armistice is going to be negotiated.
Now, the reason, or at least a major reason, that the Germans felt they needed to take this roll of the dice is that, although, as you say, it was a stalemate, so you think nobody's really winning or winning decisively at this point, so maybe it can just go on indefinitely. With the Germans, it certainly could not, because they were feeling the effects of that British blockade, which was resulting in terrible consequences for the German population in terms of malnourishment and so on. So they, my understanding is they felt like, we've got to make one last major push here. We can't just sit here and let the clock run out.
Well, and I think that's exactly right, Tom. And it's also related to the origins of the getting the Americans into the war. That goes back to January 1917, when the Germans decided that they would resume unlimited submarine warfare, which just simply meant that they would fire on Allied ships without warning, and that they would fire on ships that they took to be carrying armaments and so forth. And that unlimited submarine warfare, in the end, gave the Americans a reason to come in.
Yeah.
And they worried about it a lot. I mean, they worried about that. But on the other hand, the blockade that you mentioned was starving them out. And they thought, well, the only way we can counter that blockade is with this measure. And this was a very deep debate that the aggressive parts of the government and the military won. And so they declared unlimited submarine warfare in February, and then the United States declared war on Germany in April. So that's the origin of that. It was kind of one of the British admirals said, well, you know, it's going to come down to whether we blockade them and starve them out, or whether they blockade us and starve us out with their submarines. So, again, that was viewed as a stalemate on the sea, too.
And it seems as if the strategy there would have to have been, yes, this is likely to bring the U.S. into the war, but we will try our darndest to win the war before they have time to organize and get their people over here.
Exactly, exactly, yeah. And indeed, it took longer than one might think. And Pershing was an energetic professional soldier and created the American First Army from, you know, from the top down and the bottom up, and trained and trained and trained, and he refused to. The British, you see, wanted to use American troops. I think we've talked about this before. Wanted to use American troops as just replacements in their own units. They said, well, you know, you're nearly British. I think they forgot about that little rebellion that came about in the United States, in the colonies, in the 18th century. But they said, we can use your troops as replacements. And Pershing actually wouldn't have it. I don't think he had any instructions from the American government about such a thing, but he just said, no, they're going to be in American units under American commanders. So we were out of the trenches a long time and in training and just piecemeal put in for experience and so forth. But in this crisis of the Ludendorff or the spring offensive, everybody got onto the front line. And these are the occasions when the first big battles the Americans were in, the famous Belleau Wood. It's when the American 3rd Division made a stand on the Marne and gained its enduring nickname, Rock of the Marne. And that was that whole series of spring offensives, battles that went into the summer of 1918.
Now, I know that in the United States, it wasn't until the 1930s that we got formal polling institutions. So assessing public opinion is always a tricky thing before you have that. But we do know, obviously, that there was a great deal of unhappiness in Russia about the war, because that certainly seems to have contributed to some of the revolutionary fervor, was a profound unhappiness with the war, the casualties, the unpreparedness, go pick up a weapon from a deceased Russian soldier on your way to the front kind of advice. And that led to explosive results, but it didn't lead to explosive results in other countries, in the Western countries. And I wonder why that is, that this thing was the worst catastrophe anybody had seen, and yet people are still sending their men out to go fight it. What do we know about where public opinion stood in 1918?
Well, we know a good bit. I mean, first we start with America just briefly. I mean, we were, compared to the European powers, we were just in the war for a short time, of course. And that public opinion in the United States was separated from it. There was plenty of propaganda and, as you say, kind of mobilization of public opinion in the United States without as many deaths. I mean, the French lost in the first 4 months alone, 1 million casualties, about a third of those killed. So, you know, that's more than the United States would lose in the whole war. So there's not that kind of thing going on. In Russia, as you mentioned, what happens is collapse, and there was so much disorganization and corruption there. The German army seems to have stood firm, the Austrian army pretty firm, with the exception of some units throughout the war. And I think that these twin engines of propaganda and, you know, this feeling that people had of loyalty and patriotism, I think that that just kept these fighters going in the field. I mean, many were depressed and discouraged, and people at home, especially in Germany and in France, all had relatives and friends killed, but they stood firm. Now, it's also true that in France, there's a lot of research, Tom, on public opinion in France in particular. There's not this hasn't been done as much for Germany and some of the other powers, but in France, it so happens school principals were called on by the government to have teachers report to them the moods that the children displayed in war-related matters. And so there's this massive group of reports from French schools sent to Paris that are still in existence. And, you know, there was some discouragement, but the people at home kept on plugging away. There's not a huge amount of discontent. On the other hand, there was an enormous French mutiny on the Western Front in May 1917, in which about a third of the whole French part of the Western Front went through a mutiny in which soldiers didn't say, we're going to leave these trenches and go home. They didn't say, we're going to kill the officers. They didn't say, you know, any of the sort of those kinds of mutinous things. They just said, when we're ordered out there one more time into no man's land to be machine gunned and blown up by artillery, we're not going to do it. We're just going to be in these trenches. And you know, if they come at us, we'll fight, but we are not going to attack and be murdered. So this disrupted the organization of the Western Front. And it's another reason why the Allies thought, well, they were very depressed. And that was even after the Americans had declared war. But there was all the year of 1917, I think, leaders on both sides thought it might be up for grabs.
I know this is kind of a little earlier than the time frame we're talking about, but that whole Christmas truce thing of 1914, there's a production that's going to be on Broadway for only about 6 weeks. So I'm going to try and catch it while I'm there later this month, called All is Calm. And it depicts the 1914 Christmas truce. And I think it would be interesting to see, because there, of course, we needed that to happen on a much larger scale than just the one day. But yes. That's just such a great and interesting moment. But I want to stay focused, just for the sake of time, on 1918 and this sort of year, but also looking back on the whole war in terms of its significance. Now, militarily, obviously, we can say there are a great many military innovations that come about during World War One. I mean, the tank, the machine gun, large-scale use of poison gas, and we could go on and on. But what about non-military innovations that are still with us? Could we say, for example, that the mobilization of the state's resources for propaganda purposes is an innovation of World War One specifically? What other features of our modern world, for good or bad, do you think come out of this war?
Well, and I, you know, as one of my sort of leading themes in my mind about this war is that so much that had begun before was not necessarily invented, but was certainly accelerated during the war. And that goes for the kinds of things you're talking about, too. So there was a sense of propaganda and governments trying to sway these new mass democracies that had emerged. But in terms of, in terms of what they did during the war. I mean, it just goes light years ahead in trying to keep people persuaded and propagandized and mobilized. And also the word was coined basically during the war. And it was coined, Tom, in a quite positive way. And so when government bureaucrats talked about propaganda in Western Europe, in France or Germany or Britain at the end of the war, they didn't have this pejorative feel that we give to that word. They meant it just as kind of public relations and or government's public relations. But yeah, there's that. There's the world was already quite experienced in inflation, but you know, the crucial importance of inflation that goes through the war, every government stealing from its citizens, transferring massive wealth. Otherwise, the war couldn't have been fought, because if they had tried to pay through taxes, people would have revolted. And if, you know, they had already borrowed up to the hilt in most cases, except for the United States. So, you know, you get these inflation-ridden economies, prices go up, up, up. The hyperinflations don't occur until the end of the war. But this is one part of the end of the war, if we want to move to that period, that's important to note, that there was total economic dislocation based on these inflationary economies that had become essential to keep paying for all the artillery shells and artillery pieces and machine guns and whatnot during the war. So at the end, there is just massive chaos. There's hyperinflation in Poland, hyperinflation in Hungary, the great inflation in Germany, but even high inflation, what economists are now naming just high inflation, which is pretty horrible on its own, but high inflation in France and numerous other places. So the financial regime was, you might say, they had pioneered a new level of using inflation to transfer wealth secretively. So that's another innovation. And you know, Tom, there are also innovations. This is a constant discussion, of course, among people who are against aggressive war and so forth, and that is, do any innovations come that are worthwhile come out of war? And I can think of a couple here that I am glad happened. I'm sorry they happened under these circumstances, but there were so many facial wounds in this war that the British especially were interested in trying to figure this out. British doctors and British surgeons, and they practically invented modern plastic surgery and processes that were very primitive at the beginning of the war, got to be quite sophisticated by the end of the war. And there's that type of thing. Some infections were cured in the course of the war with various means. But by and large, you know, the results of this war were absolutely dreadful and left Europe and the world, the whole world, in a shambles. You know, another thing that happens is the flu. And we can say, well, the Spanish flu, that was not caused by humans, but in fact, it was caused by humans being grouped together in these huge, enormous camps together, and that allowed the virus to spread. So I'm going to blame the Spanish flu on this war too.
Yeah, I can understand why. Can you tell us something about the actual German decision to go ahead and sign the armistice and bring this to a close? Because Hitler obviously later pointed to what he called the stab in the back, and the claim being that the German military had not really lost the war on the ground. They were betrayed. Mm-hmm. So is there anything to that, or is that entirely propaganda?
I think that's entirely propaganda, Tom. And I've thought about this for a long time. And even as far back as when I was writing my dissertation, I was in the Federal Archives in Germany, deep into this period of time, because my dissertation covered the very end of the war and the beginning of the post-war in Germany. And here's my take on that. The German army faced all these powers for a long time. And as Niall Ferguson and others have pointed out, they killed more soldiers than they had soldiers killed per capita. So it was a big effort, but they lost the war in the field. And you can't bring in one American army, and that's by August, then two American armies by September, and a third ready to get in by the end of the war. You can't bring in 500,000 soldiers and the biggest economic power on the earth and win. So That is to say, they lost that army in the field. The effective commander, Hindenburg was the commander-in-chief, but the effective chief of staff, the one calling the shots, was Ludendorff. And Ludendorff wrote in August hysterical telegrams. I've read those in the original telegrams to the government of Germany, which he had been the dictator of pretty much in the last 2 years. And now he says to these civilians, oh, you've got to make peace. So he ran Germany into the ground. He wouldn't negotiate. There was actually a parliamentary peace resolution, really courageously led by the great center party or Catholic party politician, Matthias Erzberger, in 1917, who in the midst of the war said, we need to stop this war and negotiate a peace. It's just too horrible. So there was even that, but Ludendorff said no, no, no. He said yes, yes, yes to unlimited submarine warfare. So he ran the country into the ground, and with his great offensive in the spring, which, by the way, didn't quite work, then he signals to the civilian government, okay, you guys take care of this, make a peace, make a truce. We got it. And he pressures and pressures. He was really having a nervous breakdown at this time. And so the Germans actually thought, well, okay, but to make a peace, the current government that are just toadies to the military, they could never approach the Allies and do any good. And by the way, the best thing to accept would be Woodrow Wilson's 14 points. See, in January, Wilson had made that famous speech in which he put out these principles for making peace in Europe, highly criticized by many at the time, also highly praised. And the Germans said, well, this sounds reasonable. Let's approach him. But Wilson hates above all the German aristocrats and Prussian aristocrats, so we'll put in a new government. And they did. They put in a liberal government under a member of the royal house of Baden, named always called Prince Max. His name was Maximilian, but he's always called Prince Max of Baden. And under this government, it's a multi-party government, and of the middling parties, not the highly nationalist parties in Germany. And this government wants to negotiate, sends on October 3rd a letter to Wilson. There's several notes back and forth, and they think they're getting a peace on the principles stated in the 14 points. So they take the guy who happens to be in Prince Max's cabinet, who had gotten that peace resolution passed, Matthias Erzberger, and they get him to go to the French. They've sent notes to Wilson, they've sent notes to the French, and they appoint Erzberger the head of small commission to go and secure a truce. Erzberger hates every minute of it. He is this, nobody wants to be the person who surrenders, right? And especially after the whole German public had been beefed up on victory after victory after victory. In the midst of this, in the government of Prince Max, Ludendorff gains his nerve again and says, no, we must fight on. But the cooler heads prevailed, and they went through with this negotiation. It's an amazing story. Erzberger and these two or three military officers making their way in an open car to the Western Front, and they manage in the dark to contact the French. It's all prearranged, but who knows what can happen in a beehive like that. And they actually took their cars across no man's land, crossed it right into the French territory. And then they were a little later put on a railway car that took them to a remote, desolate spot in the middle of this vast forest of Compiègne. So nobody wanted to do it, but they thought, well, at least we have Wilson's kind of premise here, which was that, have a piece of understanding and self-determination and kind of it's got a lot of progressive overtones to it. So it's like the progressive liberalism of that day. And it sounded better to the Germans than what the French might offer.
Yeah, there was the sense that there'd be an impartial settlement.
Yeah, that was what happened. But when these peace delegates led by Erzberger got to the railway car, the person they were negotiating with was Ferdinand Foch, who was the commanding general of all the Allied armies. Foch just simply handed them terms. They had talks over 3 days. I wouldn't call them negotiations. There were a few little minor corrections. For example, Foch demanded that a certain number of submarines had to be destroyed because the Germans had to basically disarm themselves in that moment. And by number, Foch demanded that this many submarines be destroyed. And they had to tell him that Germany doesn't have that many submarines. They couldn't destroy that many. So just a few little corrections like that. And basically, Foch's demands stood. And so Erzberger wired Berlin, and everybody, all heads, even Ludendorff by this time, not really commanding the army anymore, but even he sent a message, even Hindenburg sent a message and said, no, you've got to do this. We have to have peace. You know, as he left, one of the last notes he got from the chancellor, Prince Max, who was a pretty admirable person, he wrote a note to Erzberger that said, do what you can for us. Get as much mercy as you can find, Matthias, but for God's sake, make peace. So Erzberger was behind a rock in a hard place and accepted these terms. And that's how the truce started. So the armistice is of course, just simply a large-scale truce. In German, it's a beautiful word, Waffenstillstand, the weapons being, you know, standing silent. And then that was issued to all commanders on the Western Front on the evening of November 10th. These negotiations took about 3 days, or talks took about 3 days in the forest of Compiègne. And they just set the time for the 11th hour of the 11th minute of or the 11th day of November. So may I share a story with you from 11 o'clock on November 11th?
Please do.
There's a wonderful autobiography that I think every American should read, and it's called Rickenbacker. Eddie Rickenbacker was a famous race car driver before the war, America's leading fighter ace during the war, and then the founder of Eastern Airlines and a preeminent entrepreneur and businessman after the war. And he was the commander of the 94th Aero Squadron, the famous American fighter unit. And they got a call on the evening of November 10th because they were flying a mission on November 11th early in the morning, and they got a call from their commanders. He was in charge of his squadron, but their squadron was supposed to go out, and so they canceled that. And they said, basically, we've got word the war is over. It's going to be over tomorrow. It's 11 o'clock tomorrow, and people just, the scene he describes among all these pilots who went up and met death all the time, it's just extraordinary. They're leaping up and down and dancing around saying, I've survived the war, I've survived the war. So they're all forbidden to go up in the air the next morning. And Rickenbacker was kind of your preeminent rule breaker. And he strolled out at about 10 o'clock and had his crew warm up his plane. He said he wanted to do an engine check. And then he just took off, flew above the Western Front, made his way to spots that he knew very well since he had been fighting over them. And it was a low cloud cover, so he was low and he was being shot at by the Germans. But he timed it and watched this happen. He said at first, 11 o'clock happened, and the different colors of uniforms from both sides walked out into no man's land very tentatively, shouting and hugging and celebrating. And gradually those two groups move together. It's like a Christmas truce, except it's the ultimate Christmas truce, that they move together. And then he said they finally mingled and you couldn't tell any distinct colors from 500 feet in the air. And everybody celebrating joyously, people exchanging things. He was so low, he could see the individuals. So I think that's a wonderful sight. He said, I had a front row seat. In fact, I was the only audience member of the greatest show on earth.
Wow, that is beautiful. That's really beautiful. Well, I'm going to have to keep you for one more question, because I think this really is the question. And I guess it does kind of bring in the Versailles settlement, which we haven't gotten into. So somehow we're going to have to cope with the fact that we didn't cover that. And maybe we'll cover that in 2019. We'll have an episode on that. But I want to know, what are the long-term consequences for Europe as a result of this war and the settlement that follows from it? Is there any good that comes out? And if there's some bad that comes of it, what's the bad?
Tom, I just can't I just can't see any great long-term effects at all. I think it was kind of a design for a century that would be violent. I think the brutality of the war itself carried on and then was expanded on in many forms. I think that the ways that governments manipulated their populations created total war governments, even aside from the fact that Mussolini was an Italian front fighter, Hitler was a Western front fighter. I mean, there's these connections to the war, but all the totalitarian regimes that we think of emerged in the war, and all of the others were changed too. I mean, it's in the immediate wake of these things that, as you and I know very well, that Ludwig von Mises was desperately fighting to keep basically a totally socialist regime from taking over Austria at the end of the war. And Mises saw it in terms of the end of civilization. That's the fight he was thinking about. And so that fight, in essence, has gone on ever since that to keep even governments that don't think they're totalitarian from becoming becoming interventionist, and in that sense leading to these demise of individual autonomy and these things. So I think that's another long-term effect. Oh my goodness, when we talk about territorial and economic issues, it's really a broken world in these years between the two wars. And of course, it becomes even more broken with the Second World War. But I think the territorial settlement alone was enough to set up problems, massive problems for the future, by drawing artificial lines and where the people, in the name of self-determination, that didn't really belong there, and so forth and so on. So I don't see much good about this. I think it really did sort of set up a blueprint for the century that came, and that was a pretty awful century.
Your book is The Great War, Western Front and Home Front. I recommend this book to everybody who asks me for a good book on World War I. And sometimes that's on Facebook. I'll see people conversing about it. And everybody's got a suggestion. And I say, whoa, 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 what about Hunt Tooley's book? This is the one you should be reading. And it's also nice that it's of manageable length. You don't have to worry that it's 950 pages. You can get through it. And it's packed with interesting stuff, just as this episode was. But also, it's written by an Austro-libertarian, I would say. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you certainly seem like one to me. And and I see Rothbard in your footnotes.
I seem like one to me, too.
Okay, good, good, good. I never expressly asked you that before. But when I look at your, you know, I see Rothbard in your footnotes. That's never by accident. Nobody accidentally comes across Rothbard and puts him in the footnotes. So I like that. And I also, you know, this is Palgrave Macmillan. That's no small achievement to publish with a, you know, prominent publisher like that. So this is definitely the book on World War I, The Great War, Western Front and Home Front. And incidentally, I'll also point out that when I haven't told anybody this except the people who bought the products, but when I was working on the Ron Paul Homeschool project, I got to the point where I had done about 400 videos and I just could not continue it. It was so overwhelming how difficult and just exhausting the project was. So I had a few dozen more videos still to go, and I went to Hunt and I said, look, Hunt, I'll pay you whatever you need, but I am begging you to finish these for me, because I knew he's great and knowledgeable about modern European history, and that's what I was getting into in the second of the Western Civ courses. So the very last bunch of lectures in that second Western Civ course that I did is Hunt Tooley teaching the rest of the stuff so that I wouldn't die. So I, you know, the least I can do is promote your book when, you know, you prevented my death.
Oh, Tom. Well, you know what? There were moments in there when I thought, many moments when I thought, how did he do all those things? I just could not imagine.
I know.
An amazing work that you did. But I do want to say, once again, thank you for for plugging my book and for having me on many more times than this time over the years. I really appreciate it. I'm, as you know, one of your biggest fans, and I'm happy to be on the program anytime.
Well, thank you so much, Hunt. I appreciate it very much. And thanks also for talking to me while you're trying to attend a conference. I appreciate that. Thanks a lot.
I prefer this to the actual session in progress. But
I've been to a lot of history conferences. I know exactly what you're talking about. Thanks again.
Thanks, Tom. Bye-bye.
All right, folks, that's going to do it for today. You are really, 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 really going to enjoy my brand new ebook, Collecting Some of the Stories of Professors Who Stood Up to the PC Mob. The book is called Think for Yourself, Professors Who Resisted the Mob Tell Their Stories. You can get it at againstthemob.com, and I'll see you next week.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.